and all this other issue, and there's a communication issues and all this other thing. So most of the departmental members are committed on that regard. But I'm here, being delegated to represent the department. My name is Matthew Spanjian. I'm heading the electricity policy at the department. And I'll be presenting the departmental position on the mentioned issue. In terms of the presentation outline, I will touch base on the background, the electricity pricing policy mandate, and the electricity pricing policy principle, and the issue of funding the IRP, the integrated resource plan, protecting the poor, and challenges and status, and then I'll conclude. Just to say that in terms of the background, what has happened, which is well known, that then initially since 1995 we had NER, which was later termed NERSA, and there was initially an issue of municipalities in terms of the lot of municipalities which was ultimately rationalized, and we are around having around, inclusive of all the municipalities, around 278 municipalities. Just to say that I won't go detail to some of the issues. I'll try to focus in terms of the mandate that we're given by this chamber. To say that in line with the MYPD in 2005, it was decided that we should move to the MYPD. And then there was a process that was followed, and which cascade to date. The National Energy Regulator, which was established in 2005, started its operation there, and NERSA then was regulated by the electricity industry since 1995 until 2006. Just to say that also in terms of the, on the date of 2007, the first MIP was submitted by ESCOM, and it included the rule to change to reduce their revenue and risk and exposure that was applied. And also just to say that in 2009-2010 financial year, ESCOM was granted 14.2%, which was translating into 12% increase for municipalities. And there was a other process that also went through around the MIPD, which some of them were not mentioned here. And in 2008, in December, after the long process of developing a pricing policy for the country, Department of Energy introduced the electricity pricing policy, which was adopted and it was published, which then came as a guiding document for the electricity pricing. And just to say that in January 2009, now when then the electricity pricing policy was there, the MOP2 was done, even though the principles in the electricity pricing policy was implemented by NERSA, it was gradually implemented because some of them needed the time to be implemented, which some of them are still being implemented now. But just to say that in ESCOM submitted the MIPD2 then in March, and by the end of 2009, they obtained the necessary approval for implementation in March 2010. And despite that large nominal increase in ESCOM prices, in real terms, it is still below the price level experienced during the generation expansion in 1970 in terms of the calculations. But I'll touch base on that later. Just to say that if you recall well, the mandate for electricity pricing comes from the ERA, which is the Electricity Regulation Act, and the electricity pricing policy, as I've mentioned. And those are the clause, Section 15 of the ERA, which talks to the electricity pricing. But I would like to emphasize that the section talks to the regulation of revenues that must allow an efficient license to recover the full cost of the license and include the reasonable margin or a return. So I thought this will also be critical in terms of our discussion. And just other thing, in terms of also the issue in terms of charge and tariff, we must give the end user proper information regarding the cost and their consumption that imposes on the licensed businesses. And also the issue of cross subsidy may be permitted on the tariffs for a certain class of customers. We shall also will touch base on that. Well, on that, on the last note, I also want to emphasize that as the pricing policy talks, the regulator is responsible for regulatory methodology in detail, but the regulatory methodology is used in order to ensure that the revenue is allowed and charges and tariffs are complied with the requirements of the Act. So a part of the regulatory methodology is purely the regulator responsibility. And just to say that, just touching base in some of the principles that I won't go details into them because we have almost 60 policy statements on the electricity pricing policy. But I'll just mention that we have almost 60 policy statements on that pricing policy. But the critical principles and objectives of that principles are around the following issues: to improve the social equity by addressing the needs of the poor, which is well prioritized on the pricing policy. Enhance efficiency and competitiveness to provide low cost and high quality inputs to all sectors. Environmentally sustainable short and long term usage of natural resources. Open non-discriminatory access to the transmission system. And private sector participation in industry. Universal access to the electricity. And investment in the infrastructure to ensure sustainability, which is very critical for now in terms of our present MOPD, which I'll touch base on. Just to say that also in terms of accelerated access to electricity by the previously disadvantaged people, it's one of the priority. Improving of technical and economic efficiency with which the services are being provided. Efficient use of electricity as a scarce resource, lower cost of electricity as an input to economic activity, and poverty net for the indigent. And lastly, more renewable energy generation and energy mix. So those are policy principles that all those 60 statements encompasses, just to make sure that all these objectives and principles are adhered to. The issue of the principle of how to approach the pricing policy, that's mainly around this graph. To say that, let's take that blue line maybe as if it was the real cost of electricity, and the if you use two-part tariff, there will be a bit of subsidy to those people that cannot afford, because the understanding is that the more you use the electricity, the more you can afford, and the less you use, those are people who cannot afford. So basically, there's a room for subsidy there in terms of the present approach, which then also cascades to the present IVT that is being implemented in the municipality, to say that the more you use, the more you pay, because then it also assists in terms of energy efficiency. So that's basically how the two-part approach in terms of our policy works. But it's an international norm that has been used in order to for electricity pricing. Before I want to touch base on in terms of the statement that I said about one of the critical issues for now is the funding of the new generation. While acknowledging that we need new investors in the industry, to a certain extent there's a need to fund the new generation. I won't go to the number crunching of the IRP, as most of this presentation has been done several times in this chamber. I will just say that in a sense that if you look at the generation required for the next few years and the new investment and the new power station required to be built or to be developed in South Africa, we really need a lot of capital. And to a certain extent, there's a push to say that how do we and is whether we get the private investors or how we get how we fund it, we really need a fund for it. But in terms of the policy, in terms of our understanding, is that we really need to keep the industry sustainable, and the only way to sustain it is to make sure that we plan and make sure that there's a future capital investment in case we don't get the private investors. I'll go detail into it in the next slide. And looking at different types of technologies like nuclear, that is capital intensive, and any other, some of the related energy sources that are required to keep the lights on in South Africa in the few coming years, we really need to make sure that we plan well for the future. Just to say that if you compare our prices with China and the likes of India and developing countries per se, to say that if you look at the graph, and looking also in our policy, the way we approach it is that there's a more demand for electricity in the coming years. So it means that the more electricity we need, the more capital that will be needed. And if you look at this graph, we're using the 2009 figures. And if we use the present approach, we might have to go a bit. But the critical point is that the electricity in South Africa, it will still be affordable comparatively to the likes of the developing countries and other bigger countries that are similar to South Africa, like China and India. So in real, the South African electricity is still a bit lower, and it will be still be lower in terms of our present policy when you compare it with other countries. And also to say that just comparing different alternative price paths, to say that if you look at the present source of energy and the present IRP in terms of how we approach it, to say they differ in terms of the pricing and even if the methodology used by NERSA at the moment, the regulator at the moment, there will always be that price difference in terms of the different source of energy. And we use the 2010 figures to try and illustrate that. We can go to the details if the question arises in terms of it. I would like to focus on the present issues in terms of the regulatory model in the industry, and also in terms of the present process of electricity pricing. Understanding that there's a process now that is ongoing in terms of the MIP3, which is purely the regulator, independent regulator process, which I think you'll touch base on it. The issue of MIPD to a certain extent in terms of timing for now, in terms of the department, we're still looking at how we're going to look at reviewing the policy to a certain extent, or re-looking at the policy, let me use the right word, re-looking at the policy if there's a possibility of having additional years in terms of MIPD. As you remember, we have a 3-year MIPD process, maybe as the minister once said, that maybe we need to look at the additional years. But so far, the department has never published any document on that regard. We're still looking at that. So the pricing policy still stays as it is, and I think all the stakeholders in the industry, they still following the process as it is, including ESCOM and other institutions, in terms of the submission of the MIPD to NERSA, and NERSA is also following the same process. Just to say that in terms of the way average cost of capital, which is the method that is used mainly around the electricity price path, impact of ESCOM financing in terms of high debt ratio and low interest coverage is noted. And we're hoping that as the process unfolds, some of the issues and the details of that will be taken into the consideration, but I know Nelson will go deeper into the issues around the methodology. The need for trade-offs between placing additional funding burden on electricity consumers, which is very critical, or taxpayers. What we're basically saying is that by getting the real price of electricity to a certain level, in line with what it's supposed to be, or moving towards the real cost of electricity, might need a steep approach or real numbers in terms of going to the real price of electricity. But the lesser we go, then it means that there might be a challenge around additional funding required for the industry, mainly for generation and other projects or other processes in the projects in the industry. So on that regard, it then goes as government to sit down and say that whether do you want to approach it in that steep approach, or maybe the government will ultimately find some projects to a certain extent. But this brings a challenge to the whether you do it will be a cost to your customer, or when it's a taxpayer, it will be a cost to the whole South Africans, or by which mainly that taxpayer will be done through government support to Eskom and electricity industry. I think that in terms of what I wanted to explain in this. Just coming to the protection of the poor before I go to the conclusion, because there's a critical issue around the industry in terms of whether the present pricing, are we really protecting and making sure that we protect the poor people to a certain extent, whether they can be able to afford electricity. In line with the pricing policy, in line with the different programs within the electricity, there's a lot of initiatives that have been done as a mitigation to try and assist the poor community or the poor customers for affordability's sake. And for the policy part, if all these measures are taken, the poor people are well protected in case of any other increase in the electricity prices. This includes the following. That includes facilitating access to electricity through government subsidy of electrification, the INEP program, which everybody, which most of us knows about it, which is implemented by department through different municipalities. The second part is free basic electricity, which was introduced in 2002, and it has been implemented by different municipalities. Even though there and there we do have municipalities, the free basic electricity policy stated the 50 kilowatts should be a subsidy by government, and to a certain extent, yes, it's been implemented, even though some municipalities use different figures, high and low. The other measure is the free connection provided to Eskom low consumption residential customers, and the other measure include lower price increases applied to low consumption domestic customers, and also NERSA is helping us on that one. The other one, which is a present implementation, which is also the pricing policy, is the IBT incline block tariffs, which is being implemented by municipalities. And we do have also some challenges in terms of implementation, but so far the department and NERSA and different stakeholders are trying to make sure that the incline block tariffs are getting implemented, which will definitely benefit the poor customers. Just to say that in terms of the electricity pricing policy, it mentions that the qualifying customer shall be subsidized through application of a lifeline tariff. And that tariff is a single energy rate, and it's not fixed. It's not that a fixed charge, and it's limited to capacity of 20 amps of the nominal connection fee, which NERSA always publish the tariff payer. Annually. Well, we still believe that further options that could be implemented include the following, which we know some of the municipalities are using these measures to assist the poor people, poor customers, to afford the electricity, which include increasing the FBA volume. Some of the municipalities are giving up to 70, 80, and depending on their poverty and their affordability to a certain extent, they can always assist the poor. principle of cost of supply and cost subsidies needs further policy refinement for equitable tariff structure and tariff levels, so that we shouldn't find that to a certain extent when all these measures are implemented, we ultimately harm the profit or the sustainability of utility or municipality to a certain extent. And also, the municipality can be able to afford the cost of supply and limiting cost subsidy to a certain extent, or increasing them depending on the affordability. So that is a principle that needs further refinement. Just want to conclude that, as some of our statements, as we always mention, that in terms of some of the challenges around the electricity pricing, there might be a need for refinement. But so far, there's no refinement, as I've mentioned. But the department is constantly reviewing the policy, and if there's any other review that will be taking place, will have to be presented here and ultimately also be published for public comments. So there's no, for now we're still looking at different types of approach in terms of the review, if we have to review the policy or relook at the policy to a certain extent. Poverty alleviation is still an important challenge, as I've mentioned, for the country. And as you know, that electricity per se is the main economic input to a certain extent. So when it goes to poverty, the link between the poverty and energy is very clear and it's very huge. So the electricity pricing policy also introduces the mitigation for protection of and upliftment of the poor, as I've mentioned. And just to say that also, we really need to, this was a milestone in terms of the pricing policy, I mean pricing approach, because in terms of the previous record, when you look at the pricing regime, this policy closes most of the gaps that were created, especially in terms of regulatory certainty, which is very, very critical for now. And it also say that for if you really need to have investors in this industry, sustain this industry, we really have to create regulatory certainty. And I guess that's one of might be the reason why we, the department, as one mentioned, that maybe we need to look at extending the MYPD and the pricing policy to other 5 years or some few years, so that there should be more certainty, especially in terms of regulation. And lastly, we still believe that the cost of electricity in South Africa is still a bit lower. It's only that it was previously low, and that if we have to talk about the cost of supply, and also sustaining the industry and making sure that we look at the future in the sense that there will be a sustainable industry, we really need to watch the cost of electricity to a certain extent, and the future of the investment from the large nominal increase in electricity prices, which is now might be a challenge to a certain extent. Also looking at the economic aspects of the present time that you are in. So it's a real challenge for the policy side, it's a real challenge for NERSA in terms of that, but the reality remains that to a certain extent the customer needs to pay the real cost of the supply. And I think on that note, I'll leave it there, and thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. Then proceed to NERSA. Mr. Bukula and your team, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, my name is Tembani Pukula. I'll be giving the presentation on NASA. Our presentation really was structured around the lines where the brief was that we must talk about the concept, the rationale, talk about the two or the multi-year price determination that we've had, as well as the interim and additional tariff applications that we've had in the process, and then finally talk about the process that will be followed for the third multi-year price determination. So I'm going to take you through the presentation, but I also want to say that I saw the presentation by Mr. Matthews from DOE. It covers some of the elements, so I will go faster and quickly through those. But when the multi-year price determination was started, it was started because we used to have these annual determinations of the price increase. And at that stage, it used to really to be an ESCOM NER or an ESCOM NASA matter. And the determinations were really inflation-related. But the process of determining that, even though you were going to do it for a year, you still had to go through the same processes. You still had to have 30 days of public consultations, 15 days of this. The process that you undertook just to do a determination for 1 year was as cumbersome as the process that you followed to do a determination for 3 years. The limitation with the annual determinations at the time was that there was no way you could do any forward planning. If you link that with the second point that I had, at that time we already knew that we have got a very old infrastructure, both the generation, the transmission, and the distribution, so there's a need to reinvest, replace, refurbish that infrastructure. But when you do annual determinations, you don't have a way of planning forward. The other part that it had is that on the regulated entities themselves, ESCOM in particular, you also did not have an ability of making them look forward and plan forward and extract the efficiencies that you are required to extract as a regulator. Hence, then, there was a determination that we need to start determining the prices over a long period. And this was also something that businesses and investors were promoting, to say that when we plan, we know that there's going to be an increase in prices. We know that there's going to be investments into the system. But we need to find a way of planning forward with some numbers that would give us some certainty. And additional to that was the fact that we were starting to have a view of the investments that would be required, especially on the generation side, that then required ESCOM to start building its own reserves and retained earnings so as to strengthen its own balance sheet and enable more borrowing. And it was around that then that the concept of the multi-year price determination was done. There are many methodologies of regulating. Rate of return is one of them. Incentive-based regulation is one of them. The one that we started with, which is the determination of the allowed revenues, which then you can calculate your average prices for, is to a large extent a hybrid of these different models, a hybrid that suits and fits the South African situation. This is where we would calculate whatever the projected costs are, and out of that, with the sales, we determine what the revenue ESCOM would require. We then, most multi-year price determinations in countries that use this, they have a 5 to 7 year term, but most of them do that after having practiced for a number of attempts before they decide that 5 is the better one or 7 is the more appropriate one. We started with the 3 year because we were not at that stage clear about all of the assumptions that we needed to have. But we thought that the 3 year will give us a nice base to start from, and we made certain assumptions, and most of the costs that we had in that in the assumptions that we made were that all costs would increase with inflation, and this was now in 2005 when these assumptions were made. We also wanted to do certain things, but in whatever we do with the prices, we must not reduce or alter the credit rating of ESCOM. We also assumed that the government or the shareholder will not be taking any dividends from ESCOM, and then started formulating the multi-year price determination from then. In some of the things that we did, that if these assumptions that we are making are wrong, for instance, if the changes in the costs are in excess of 10%, then we are going to have to reopen. If there are other exogenous factors like we have had in 2008, the economic meltdown and many other things, we may have to then relook at that. So that was really the concept to say we will try and look forward and project what the prices would be and then work around that in ensuring that we extract the efficiencies we can extract from Eskom, but at the same time ensure that we steer in a path that is pretty well-defined, a cone, if I may say that. Now, with the first determination, which was from the 1st of April 2006 to the 30th of March 2009, I think we had many of these principles that I mentioned before, that we assumed cost increases would be according to inflation, and we assumed that the dividends would not be taken. At the time, there was no electricity pricing policy, so the one piece of legislation that was there was the Electricity Regulation Act, which had a statement that is still valid and good till now, that when we set the tariffs and the prices, we must ensure that an efficient licensee recovers using the full costs and also gets a reasonable return. So that was the principle that was used to that. And at that point, we also were aware of the fact that there is additional capacity that is required, and we need to have a tariff that takes that into consideration. This is the principle that the pricing policy has also taken into consideration. And the funding of Eskom at that time, I think it was still during the request for information, the two power stations were going to cost 33 billion rand each, and the amounts that were in Eskom, the balance sheet and the retained earnings at that stage were sufficient to deal with the 33 billion rand per station. However, as part of the process, because we're also learning this, we had what we started calling the clawback, where we said that when every year we are going to review the application and look at the areas where we believe Eskom has not been efficient, and that we claw those money back, and this was the start of what developed into what we now call the regulated clearing account, which I'll talk about later on. Then the determination in 2006 was that the price increases would be 5.1, 5.9, and 6.2, and this was around CPI X then plus 1. And this was really aligned with most of what the businesses did. And I've just included the coal costs because at the time, the coal costs, they are still close to being 30% of the cost of Eskom, but at the time, they were mere 11 billion rand. And if we think of the price of the power system then, there's not the generation that has been added is not too significant. So the amount that is banned for coal in 2006 is pretty much similar to the amount of coal that is being banned in 2012. But the costs have done something very, very different, which I will show in the other part of the MYPD2 determination. Now, when we had the MYPD2 determination, we had the first year, and I think the DOE has already indicated this, that there was a change. Midway through, around April 2007, Eskom applied for an 18.7% increase instead of the 5.9% that the multi-year price determination had indicated. And at that stage, there were two main drivers. The first driver was that the coal costs had increased with the figures that were double those of inflation. And the second one, when Eskom requested the proposals for the two power stations, the cost had also moved from the 33 billion rand each to 66 billion rand each. And then at that stage, NERSA made the decision then to have the increase awarded to Eskom to be 14.2 instead of the 18.7, and what we really limited was some of the coal costs that Eskom had indicated, and we also limited the rate of return that they were anticipating in their application. It was, I think Eskom was supposed to implement the 14.2% decision on the 1st of April 2007, and on the 18th of March instead they applied for a revision of that 14.2% increase and revising it from 14.2 to 60%. And this was at the stage that now they had received the quotations for the two power stations, so the cost had now moved from the 66 billion rand each to above 90 billion rand each, and the total cost or capital expenditure at that stage was around 343 billion rand. At that stage, Eskom, with their credit rating and balance sheet, because I think they were put on negative watch by that stage, they anticipated that they could only borrow 30 billion rand versus the 60 billion rand that sort of a capital expenditure would require. And the shareholder injection at that stage was 60 billion rand, and it was over 5 years, and they still required the 10% rate of return. In the decision that we made of the 27.5% increase, I think we limited the rate of return and we tried to spread the capital expenditure and also increase the borrowing capacity. But this was at the backdrop of the fact that we then said that there's a need to now have a method or policy that's going to fund this increasing capital expenditure. So the second multi-year price determination, which was supposed to start in 2009, did not start because at that stage there was a talk of developing a funding model to deal with this huge capital expenditure. So in 2009, Eskom made an interim application, which was really to deal with the other costs that were being accumulated, because these two power stations at that stage had been decided that they would be constructed by Eskom. There was also an introduction of a 2 cents per kilowatt hour environmental levy, which had to be also paid by Eskom. And in that, NERSA approved a 31.3% increase, and this was now the start of the limitation, or the start of what the pricing policy ultimately implemented, the one of limiting certain increases to those who were considered indigent and poor and were on their home light and lifeline tariffs were then reduced or limited to only 15%. And the re-evaluation of the assets that the pricing policy was introducing was then postponed to be done in the multi-year price determination of the second period, what we now call MYPD2. And MYPD2, when it started, I think the first application or first indication was that Eskom was going to apply for a 45% increase, and I think after this process that has just been undertaken, the consultation with National Treasury and SALGA, the increase was brought down to 35%, and the drivers really at that stage was that capital expenditure, which was now 302 billion rand, the re-evaluation of the assets, which then increased both the depreciation and the assets, and then the return would then result in the return on the or for the shareholder to being a larger number. We then also had to shift certain revenue or increase certain revenues to ensure that the inclining block tariffs can be catered for, and then the pricing policy also had a statement that required the regulator to move tariffs towards cost-reflective tariffs within a five-year period. So that's what then informed the application by Eskom, and to a large extent informed the approval of the 25% on average by NERSA in on the 24th of February in 2010. And really we do know that we have had the 24, the 25, and I will talk about the other reduction of 16% for the last year, but I would also like to I will continue. I just want to bring members' attention to the coal costs. If you remember the first slide I had, the coal costs were around 11 billion rand, and Eskom's revenue in that year was around 33 billion rand, and if you look at them in 2011-12, coal costs were 33 billion rand, which is what was Eskom's revenue, and yes, they still remain in that level of below 20%, but they are still very high. Now, in the determination that we did for the multi-year price determination, although the pricing policy does not say this in particular, the re-evaluation of the assets was done or phased over a five-year period because we're trying to limit the increase or the impact of the increases. The rate of return or the weighted average cost of capital that has been spoken about was also not the 8.16% that was determined, but 8.16% was a projection of what your rate of return for an entity of this nature should be. The rate of return that was given to Eskom in the years, I think in the first year it was close to zero of the multi-year price, in the second year it was 1.2, but over the three-year period the rate of return has not been more than 2%, which was to just ensure that the prices or the price path is kept as low as possible. Yes, the inclining block tariffs, as I indicated, had this effect of having to limit the increases in that first block to about 6%, which meant that the other blocks would have to absorb that. And we then also set up what was called the regulated clearing account. Now, the regulated clearing account is the account that set up to say that there are elements where Eskom will get their costs being passed through, like the cost of coal and the cost of diesel would be passed through costs. There are elements where the staff costs, the operating costs, and the other manpower costs, where we would expect them to make certain efficiencies in that, and when they make the efficiencies, those monies they can keep. But if they've conducted all of the projects that they said they would conduct, but in the others that are just passed through costs, all of those funds would be ring-fenced, so Eskom would not be allowed to use those funds for any other purposes. And this regulated clearing account is important in that when Eskom came back with application for the multi-year price determination to say they would like to reduce their price increase from 25% to 16%, there were two drivers, really. The first driver was the fact that the capital expenditure, which was anticipated to be 100 billion rand per annum, had not materialized. Instead, Eskom had spent around 60 billion rand per annum, and we're still projecting that even in the year 2012-13, they would spend around the 65 billion rand. So as a result, the shareholder, which was getting the returns in what I indicated in the depreciation, and was then willing to rephase or forego its returns for this year. In fact, rephase is the term that has been used, which were around 7.7 billion rand. And then in the regulated clearing account, where we were doing all of these other calculations, we had a figure of around 3 billion rand. Now, we have been asked the question as to whether we could not use the regulated clearing account to reduce the price. Yes, the answer is yes, we could have, but the price reduction would have been 3% maximum. But we also had an understanding that going forward with the clearing account, had we reduced in the following year, we may have to increase that to cater for that. So the regulated clearing account could have been used. But the biggest chunk of the reduction of the 25% to 16% was the rephasing of the shareholders' returns of about 7.7%. And that's when NERSA approved the 16%. But the other allocations that were done for non-ESCOM generation, for instance, the renewables of 12.3 billion rand, those amounts are still ring-fenced and sitting and going to be used only for that. This rephasing was done on the other amounts that were not ring-fenced amounts. Now, if I may come to the part of the multi-year price determination, the third one, we know that Eskom had sent the application, as they would always do every time they apply to National Treasury and SALGA, and we understand that the 40-day period that National Treasury and SALGA given ended yesterday, the 31st of August, so we are anticipating that Eskom will give us the application. In the application, as it stands, and remember we were going to consult, and because there were anticipated changes by the Department of Energy, that did not take place, and as Matthew has explained, that they will review it if there's a need. We are going to be consulting when we receive the application from Eskom, say, within by the middle of this month, or before the end of this month. We will still use then what the electricity pricing policy says, and the issues that are big in that have a big impact on the price are really, it's the re-evaluation of the assets and whether it is phased over. In the MYPD2, as I mentioned, it was phased over 5 years, whether that is still going to be what we would do. I think the inclining block tariffs would stay as determined. There's minor tweaking that has to be done on that. The other one that now would have been in 2 years from now, the cost effectivity also has to be adjusted. I think we now have to take the term of the multi-price determination and try and ensure that what the pricing policy required is achieved. So have a 5-year term to achieve the cost reflectivity of 5 years. And we also have to include whatever costs that the integrated resources plan has included in that. I mean, the renewable energies that have been undertaken by this bid program have to be also catered for. And we also still have to come up with the price structures that will still promote the economic growth of this country. It is no secret that we can't have prices that are not sustainable to the industry, because then even our own entity cannot be sustainable. And we will have, in fact, the slide that you don't have in your notes is this slide, which really talks about the program that we plan to undertake of the consultation around the multi-year price determination. When we receive the application from Eskom around August, we plan to publish it by the 31st of August, the latest, and probably go 45 to 60 days, because it would be a process that requires, I mean, in the past we used to do it 30 days, and we have realized that 30 days is not enough. We've always been asked for extensions. We'll then collate all of the inputs in our view, by the 30th of November, we will have all of the inputs. We plan to have public hearings in January, between the 14th and the 30th of January, and finalize or approve the application around the 28th of February. But in between the time when we receive the application, the 31st of August and 30th of November, we plan to have workshops and public consultations regarding the application, and I think it is probably at that time that would also come, if we're invited with ESCOM by the portfolio committee, to come and talk around the application. But I think at that stage, maybe ESCOM would be best positioned to talk about the application. For us, it will still be an application that we are considering. We would be best positioned to come and talk about it when we have approved it or when we have done our analysis. And Jefferson, that's all about MY53. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's time for questions. May I plead with you that we just prefaced our question with short statement, not lengthy speeches. Speeches are for the House, please. Okay, I'm going to take questions. Mr. Ross, Honorable Ross, Honorable Khailen, Honorable Gadebe, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. It's such a complex issue. It's very difficult just to pop in a question, if you will allow me.
Speeches are for the House.
Okay. Chairperson, Dari question. And let me start with Mr. Bakula. Thank you very much for your presentation, sir. But I was hoping that the ESCOM application for the MIPD3, so that we can start with what it really matters, what's happening in the future, and do we have a pricing policy and what is needed in that pricing policy. And my view would be that the pricing policy that's needed is an inflation-related pricing policy. Now, the ESCOM indicated that they will be asking for a 14.6% increase again, which is way beyond inflation, and that's where the problem comes in. It makes sometimes the prices unaffordable. We thought that when we saw the reduction, that would be the trend from 24.9% to 16% when there was a reduction in electricity pricing, and we were hoping that we will move closer to inflation. Perhaps your views on that. Also, you've indicated that there will be a re-evaluation of the assets of ESCOM in the MIPD3. What would the effect be on pricing? Is ESCOM still working on the methodology of the cost of replacements of assets? Have they discarded that methodology? Because I believe that is what inflated the prices to the extent, and the re-evaluation of the assets. What would that effect be on the prices in the MIPD3? My question also to NERSA, what would your views be in terms of a pricing policy that we will see the National Development Plan take ownership of, that we have a special section in the National Development Plan in terms of pricing and funding, and that we can work towards having a pricing policy that gives certainty to the country. Chairperson, to Eskom then specifically, the funding of new generation. I was very pleased to see that there were initiatives of international Eskom bonds and alternative funding methodologies, and not only that the main burden would be on the consumer perhaps. And that is a step in the right direction. What is our progress in terms of alternative funding models? Thank you. I hope that's short enough, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I'll also try and be exemplary. I want to take it on to the other side of the equation, because here we're talking about prices in order to generate a certain amount of revenue to cover the cost of new generation. But I want to know what the regulator is doing in terms of containing or at least having oversight over the escalating costs of new generation building. I mean, it's interesting looking at this MYPD1 factors where you talk about Kasili and Medupi power stations at 33 billion rand each. Now, we would certainly hope that we could come in at 33 billion rand. But in fact, what we don't have clarity on is what is going to be the precise cost of both Medupi and Kasili, because these are obviously huge drivers in terms of the price determination going forward. And in fact, what I've seen is that this price, in terms of one article I've read now, is that the price has escalated to about 125 billion rand. And some people, when I visited Medupi about 3 weeks ago, are telling me it's closer to about 150 billion rand. What effect will that have in terms of escalating the pricing part in order to cover those particular costs? And what is NERSA doing? Do you get a six-month report from Eskom around the cost of building these two new power stations? And to what extent are you able to apply pressure in order to ensure that we come in at way below what the current estimates are coming in at? Because, I mean, clearly this is a major driver, and I'd like to find out from the regulator what control you have in terms of withholding those costs. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. We'd like to appreciate the presentation. Chair, I just want to get a clarity here, so that maybe I could check whether I understood clearly from the DOE, if they can be able to explain the issue of the trade-off between placing additional funding burden. I just want to understand that whether what is the feasible scenario is that the consumers are the ones going to be able to, you know, carry the burden, or taxpayers, government assisting in terms of ensuring that there's sustainability in terms of the electricity. That's what I just want to understand. The other one relates to the issue of the different pricings from the municipalities. I just want to get a clarity. If there's that different pricings in terms of the municipalities that you explain, to say, you know, they want to adjust in terms of their area of vicinity. If you can be able to clarify, how do you monitor that this doesn't come a burden of the poor? Because you may find that all these increases or these changes that is made by the municipalities, they go and pay to the poor people. Because if you say you want to protect the poor, you must be able also to monitor such kind of behavior, that it doesn't, you know, cost a lot of charges to the poor people. Well, to NERSA Chair, it put a smile into my face that around 2009, I was looking at NERSA dancing for the guitar of Eskom, but I can see now that, you know, they are carrying a whip, whipping behind the Eskom. Eskom is moving forward. Well, we appreciate your effort of work. I think we must be able to give at least what it should. You are really doing your job, and we must appreciate that, so that at least you get encouragement. If you can be able to give me a clarity in terms of the regulator clearing account setting up, if you can just give me clarity in terms of that one, because I couldn't get you clearly what you're trying to explain.
Lastly, I just want to check whether won't see any heavy increase of the electricity in the next 5 years. What's your assumptions in terms of ESCOM submissions and in terms of you analyzing the current status of our economy? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is on the IRP program, committed capacity. Here it's coal, nuclear, import hydro, gas, wind, and others. I see here coal is only ending up to 2015, and otherwise it's nuclear, this side, and hydro. Can you just explain that? It's on page 11. I didn't get you clearly there. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few questions from my side. To NERSA, how do you anticipate sales? Do you go through a rigorous exercise of forecasting the possible GDP numbers? I would want to be enlightened on that one. The issue of reopening of the MYPD, is it done at the request of ESCOM, or is it your own initiative as NERSA? I just want to understand the process. The second one is linked to the question by Honorable Kraling around capital expenditure. I was just looking at your methodology last night, and I would want you to enlighten me around this area in your methodology paper. You talk about capital work under construction. Now, how do you recognize that, and how do you make that capital work under construction to be part of the regulated asset base? And linked to the question of Honorable Hayden, do you receive, let's say, at a 6 month interval, the expenditure patterns of ESCOM on the work that they have done and the assumptions that have gone into that, whether it's related to exchange rates, what are the risks that they face that led to the escalation of the capital expenditure? The other question would be around prudent costs that ESCOM, that you allow for prudent costs that ESCOM might be facing. Can you enlighten this meeting also about how do you manage, how do you ensure that ESCOM manages its primary energy costs prudently? The next question would be to DOE, well, and to both DOE and NERSA. Some few years ago, I don't know whether it's still applicable now, mainly on the roads from Nelspruit, when ESCOM is transporting the coal, it was responsible for the maintenance of the roads. Though it was not its main responsibility, but it had to assume that responsibility. My understanding is that that's the responsibility of several and provincial departments. I just want to establish whether ESCOM is being compensated when you determine your price. It's compensated for the work that they do on the roads. The last question to DOE, you also here to NERSA, just presented not by NERSA but by DOE, said in your statement on slide 5 that ESCOM was required to absorb the 2 cent per kilowatt environmental levy imposed by the Minister of Finance. Can you give us a clear explanation on that, what do you mean by it?
other questions that I'll be leaving, it will be technically to the regulator to take it up.
Sorry, before you, I've just found my point. Pardon me for abusing my the privilege that I have temporarily. It's a rare privilege. If you talked about the possibility, the slide 14 about it, he's talked about the electricity path can be reduced with a lower weighted average cost of capital, which then, according to your statement, says impact on ESCOM's financing, higher debt ratios, and lower interest cover. Can you explain a bit on the statement? Because we know that ESCOM is financing most of these things through debt. So when you say you can reduce that, I'm not sure. Are you implying that the shareholder would continuously accept a lower rate of return? But what then made you to have this assumption or confidence that ESCOM's borrowing cost would be lower? I don't know. I might be reading your statement differently, but can you explain?
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members. Just to say that I'll take some of the questions and some of the questions you have agreed that they will be technically need the regulator's technical explanation. Let me start with the question of trade-offs that we mentioned in slide 14 also. I think slide 14 is very critical. Let's say that the trade-offs between placing additional funding burden on electricity consumer versus VTEX payers. Maybe let me start by saying that the real cost of electricity can also impact in terms of investment in the electricity sector. To a certain extent, even if you look at all the submissions that have been done in terms of the proposals of the new generations, if you look at the business plans in terms of it, the critical part is the price of electricity. And the more the price of electricity becomes cost reflective, the more the potential of us having investors in this country. So that in brief. But the statement then refers to a challenge where, as we have a plan trying to keep the lights on in South Africa for the next coming years, where then we will have to get to the point that we need an investment, and unfortunately, we didn't plan for it. So on that regard, when we keep the electricity as low as possible, the potential is that we might have a problem of funding the IRP or the plan as such. So on that regard, to a certain extent, it can even go to an extent of reviewing if maybe the government to a certain extent have to intervene by either funding or those projects. So it's a trade-off that we need to look at, whether we want to move towards the real cost of electricity, which indication for now is that we're still low in South Africa in terms of electricity, in terms of the real cost of electricity. So the investor's real cost of electricity is that we might have to push our electricity prices a bit higher, or not higher as such, I mean, in a real sense of saying, to come to the real cost of electricity, which then also answer this question of saying that what's the assumption of the department or NELSA in terms of few coming years. The reality of the matter is that we need funding, and when we have looked at what has transpired, the issue of funding the capital in the industry, it has been a challenge in the previous years. So one of the real mitigation is to make sure that we budget or we plan for that, and secondly, we get our electricity to the real cost of electricity, which indirectly saying that possibilities that we might have to get high electricity depending on the trade-offs that you do. The other question that I also want to answer is in relating to different prices of in municipalities in terms of electricity. I think the critical part that you should also understand is that there are issues of rate or levies in the municipalities. So to a certain extent, the customers might understand the bill, even though it might be cost reflective. That is just the cost of electricity. So in terms of the real cost of electricity, to a certain extent, not including the rates or the levies, there might be also certain difference, but I know NERSA will also go to the details of it. But from the departmental side, in line of the policy, it's a bit of an issue of regulating those prices to the real cost of electricity to a certain extent, which NERSA have to implement and make sure that they adhere to. And unfortunately, so far, from the challenge that you have, we never had a complaint whereby some of the real cost of electricity, I mean, some of the municipalities where our NERSA approved the cost that were very high in line with the real cost of electricity. But yes, it's a real challenge that we really need to look at, because you might say it's apples and oranges, and the challenge becomes when there are two municipalities that are next to each other, whereby you'll find that your cost of electricity might be higher than the other one. So we really might have to look at that, and NERSA will go into details in terms of that. I just want to run to the IRP in terms of, I don't know what happened to that slide. Okay. In the meantime, I was looking for a slide for the department. Let me address the two issues which also NERSA has agreed that they need more technical explanation, which the chair has asked, in terms of the maintenance of the road, and also the slide number 5, which slide number 14, which talks to the methodology of weighted average cost of capital, and the statement that you have mentioned. It's more of a technical explanation which goes to NERSA, which NERSA agreed to handle it. I want
it's you who has made the statement. It was not NERSA who made the statement. It's in your slide.
Let me say, you're saying electric price can be reduced with a lower weighted average cost of capital. And the cost of capital would have to do with debt and equity. You know, the rate of return that the shareholder would want. So my question was, are you making an assumption that the shareholder will always want that lower rate of return? And on the issue of debt, you mentioned the issue of the interest cover, which is basically the ability to save the debt. That's what the interest cover stands for. So are you confident that you have looked at all these issues and therefore it can support your assertion? That was just basically the question. Which is DOE which has made the statement, not NERSA.
Thank you, Chair. I will close with that one because this. Let me just go to the IRP program in terms of the question that was relating to the nuclear in terms of it. If you recall well, in terms of this IRP, which was finally approved, which you recall well, it was called the adjusted IRP program. In line with the plan, let me just say, for the nuclear, which we envisaging that will have the first megawatt or effect 1,600 megawatts in 2023. This was planned in that instant that as from those previous years, we'll then have the next power station coming in till 2029. And in line with other generation source of generation in line with the power stations that were planned, the adjustment were done according to the approval that was also done to say that the coal, which was we investigating the next power station which we just spoke about, will be also be now. But then, as time goes on, we're expecting some of the new generation, small generation from the coast, comparatively to other substations. I'm not sure whether that was the question in terms of the planning of the IRP or in terms of when it's supposed to be, but in reality, in line with this IRP, this was the one that was approved by the cabinet in the sense of saying that our plan according to the new generation should be as is. I want to go to that sensitive question that that talks to the electricity price part. mandate that we got from the regulator, I mean from the Regulation Act, is that there should be a reasonable margin of income in terms of the whoever is an investor, whether it's Eskom or whoever it is in the industry, or whoever is an utility in the industry. So in reality, what we're investigating, we're saying that the way the weight of average cost of capital should be structured, and the way the NERSA should interpret this, is that we should acknowledge the impact of the ESCOM's financing on that regard. And bearing in mind that there might be issues around lower interest rates and so forth, we NERSA have to consider it. Not really casting stones that we're concluding that in the few coming years or in the present status, that will be the status. But in reality, I think, as I've said, I wanted NERSA to go into the details of saying that that is a potential of him having when doing calculations of ESCOM financing and ESCOM capital required for the for generation, they should consider that.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will start with the questions from the Honourable Member Ross and the one about the pricing and the pricing policy and the reductions close to inflation. My starting point is that the end in mind for everyone is that we must get to price increases that are inflation related. That's the end in mind. However, I don't think that we're at the end yet. Now, the pricing policy, as it stands, says that we must do certain things. We must ensure that an efficient licensee recovers the full cost. Now, the full cost includes these big power stations at the cost that were contracted, and I will come to the part about whether it was efficient or not. But I think for now we have to accept that that's what was contracted, and that's what we have. In as far as the pricing policy, I think what it says is that prices must increase at a rate so that's the end in mind that we all have. Now, and as far as this other question you had asked about what I think or believe would be the application by ESCOM, I probably would want to take you to this slide and say that when we're doing MYPD2, ESCOM came up when they were consulting, which is the stage that they're at now, with a 45% application or increase. I don't have that application from the regulator, or the regulator does not have that application yet. The one that you're referring to is at a similar stage as the one that ESCOM had when we had the last one. They've just been consulting with National Treasury and SALCA. When they have come to us, then I think we will be in a position to express our views, and which is the process that we plan to undertake with the workshops and public consultations. And I think a lot of these, the ESCOM will have to also be part of them to explain what the reasons are and why they would be going through this process. Now, the other question you asked around the replacement method, the truth is in accounting and in most of these, there are different methods to do different things. What is always important is what is it that we are trying to achieve. In our case, we're trying to find an asset evaluation method that would enable ESCOM to recover the funds or the costs that would enable it to continue with its build program. Whether it is a depreciated replacement method or the modern equivalent asset value, I think it must bring us to a number, and that we have consulted on, and the pricing policy says we must continue to consult on it. But I also have to say it really doesn't matter which one you use. What matters is how you phase it and how it gets into the asset that you give a return on. And I think that's the issue that we grapple with in as far as how much of it must be included in the assets that they are getting a return for and how much they must be. And I think that's the matter of consultation. So I believe that my view on what the 14.06 that you've had about, if it's correct or not, I still have to see that application officially, and I think we also don't express the views. We make the determination based on what we have analyzed and understood. Now, the last question you asked around the pricing policy and the national development plan, NASA is really a creature of statute. We implement the rules that and the regulations and the legislation that we have been tasked to implement. From where we sit, I think really the idea is to find a process, whether it is by NASA, development plan, planning commission, that ensures that there's certainty in price, and we would be more than willing to align with whatever processes that are put in place. But for now, I think the planning commission is talking about big numbers. ESCOM comes up with an application, and we are required to analyze the application. And I think that it probably is not to bring NASA into that part of that. It is probably to go to ESCOM. NASA would not have to approve an application if ESCOM did not apply for that, for an increase. So let's start at the point where, why is ESCOM applying for it before we say to why is NASA approving it? So but when it's streamlined like that, we'll be happy to participate in that process. Honorable Kaling, I want to respond to your questions at the end and add them to the questions that Honorable Mloto has asked. I think the question about municipalities, Honorable Khadem, you are asking my colleague Mathis, or you were also asking me. The difference is in the prices between what ESCOM charges and what municipalities charge. It is because they are two different entities with two completely different cost structures. For instance, at ESCOM, the only thing they sell is electricity. Municipalities, they have electricity, they sell water, and so when you look at their business, electricity business, they also have different drivers. For instance, in their case, price of electricity is 70% of their costs. So when we determine the electricity price for them, we take 70% of the power purchase cost to be what makes that. Then negotiated settlement for their labor, they have a different amount for the other services that they have. They also have to make a contribution to their cross subsidies, and we have a range of figures that we use. So in most cases you'd get that. Why it never used to be different in the past when we had the CPI plus one increases was that it was so small, the difference between the two. So you had an 8% or a 6% increase or 5% increase, and the municipal one will be 4.9, so it was very close. It started being noticeable when you had the big 30% increases. That's when we started having these noticeable differences. But we can explain what the differences are. I suspect that when I keep using my hands to show 70, it's not going to help, but we'll show you then. But on the regulated clearing account, this is an account where we say that ESCOM, we have given you 100 rands to do this. At the end of the year, we want to see if you have done that. If you have not done that, that 100 rand is not yours. It must come back and be given back to the consumer. That's what the regulated clearing account is doing. It keeps a record of what's happening. And I'll come back to it when I talk about this capital expenditure, because it is also part of what will go into the regulated clearing account. But it's an account where we keep the change. But there are other measures. For instance, when ESCOM was required to use more generation from the municipalities, in that case, the amount they had budgeted for was smaller than the amount that they ended up using. So we then come into that test of whether they were efficient or not and whether they were prudent to decide whether they are going to get that additional money or they will have to find their bottom line as a way of funding that. So it is an account that does that. It is an account where we want to ensure that it is kept in a way that ensures that consumers don't pay for things that they don't have to pay for. If ESCOM has not been efficient, they must then pay for that. And if ESCOM has been efficient, but other exogenous factors came in, then they don't have to be punished for that. So it is an account that keeps that. And at last count, it was sitting at around around 3 billion rand, to give you an indication of what it is. But it can also swing the other way the following year. It can be minus 3 billion rand if they do other things that are... So I trust that it gives a feel. This is the one about the roads, and the Eskom got about 1 billion rand in the first year of the multi-year price examination and 980 million rand in that. But the process of repairing the roads was that in the first year, Eskom was going to continue repairing the roads because they were tightening the security of supply and SANRAL was not moving at the pace that was required. That's why it was allowed to be done. But going forward, Eskom was then going to pay the money over to National Treasury, who would then find a way of allocating it to SANRAL as a toll fee, and we called it a shadow toll. So Eskom pays for that because they are the ones that do inflict some of the damage in those roads. So I think they are behaving responsibly in that manner. But it is catered for. And the 2 cents levied, I think when we said absorbed, it meant that it is a pass-through. Eskom pays that, but the consumers also pay that. And the prudent costs around primary energy, ideally, Eskom should be having 90% of its coal contracts being, you know, contracts that are fixed long-term and not short-term contracts. That's the ideal situation. And the 10% is left for cases where maybe it rains a lot and then the open pit mines cannot supply, then you have these short-term contracts. However, fortunately, in what we have Eskom having close to 20-30% off their contracts being short-term contracts. So the prudence that we want Eskom to exercise that is to show us that in a coal mine that is tied to the power station, have they exhausted everything? Have they done everything to ensure that they get all of the coal from that mine before they go and get coal from the short-term contracts? And I think that is a process that that we would see what the contract says and would see what the mine has produced, and we ensure that it aligns with that. And when they get additional coal, it is not additional coal that they got because they could not manage their own contracts. And yes, I think in all of the things where you have to check the prudence and all that, you improve with time. You never get to 100%. But what is important is that we are not at 10%. We are close to the 99% in ensuring that all things are done prudently. And then the question you asked about the weighted the work under construction. This work under construction, there are many ways in accounting and in regulation where you would treat your work under construction. If you took a company that is not Eskom, that is an IPP that is going to build a power station and inject power into the system, the only time that they get an opportunity to get money from the consumers is when they are selling power into the system. When they are building and doing other things, they get nothing. Now, in Eskom's case, in the process of trying to repair the balance sheet to ensure that it has a balance sheet that enables it to borrow, it has a balance sheet that enables it to carry on with its operations, and it has the cash flows that enable it to carry on with its operations, we have had to include what is called work under construction in what we use as the asset base where they get the return. It is really a way and a method of assisting with the operations to get the necessary cash and to go through this hump. Under normal circumstances, we would not include that. Ordinarily, that's not what you include, but under these conditions, and if you look, and you also have to understand one thing, that the asset base of Eskom, because it's 40 years old, which is what my slide said, so the asset base, if you were to use the historic method of evaluation, it was sitting at around 100 billion rand. If you took one power station in the ones that were being built, just one, which was 100 billion rand, then it made it 200 billion rand. So to get a return for all of the power stations that Eskom had, you around the how we anticipate sales. This is a process that we do both with Eskom and the customers. In your energy-intensive users, we would find out what they intend to do, or Eskom finds out what they intend to do, whether they intend to increase their operations, and if they intend to add another plant, then that's what gets included in that. But generally, you can also model that generally your consumption increases by this, so it's modeling plus finding out information. But the models that are used both by Eskom and the ones that we use to verify are pretty sophisticated to a point that they don't very fall far off from what the actual consumption is. And yes, we do use the GDP numbers and all of the numbers that are required for modeling from SSA. But I think on the sales part, we have really never been far off in as far as playing both Eskom and us with our verification. On the reopening of the multi-year price determination, the multi-year price determination has got its own rules on how you reopen. But there's another one that the Act has. Eskom is allowed anytime. The law allows Eskom anytime to come and apply for a price. But even when they are allowed to do it any time, they also can't just implement any other time. As if you'd seen in what we had in the when we had the interim applications and other things, there's the 15th of March date where they must get this approval in Parliament, but generally the law allows them to ask for a reopening. But the multi-year price determination rules, which Eskom is bound by, so although they have that leeway around the law, but they are also bound by these other rules, say that if the changes, for instance, in revenue are not more than 1 or 2%, there's no need for them to apply. The discretion to open is that of the regulator. But if they are above 1%, even the regulator is obliged to open. That is on the changes in the revenue, which will be a result of the difference in the state. If the changes in the costs are less than 10%, the regulator, they may request the regulator, but it's also the discretion of the regulator. But above 10% is also not the discretion of the regulator. It's mandatory for the regulator to reopen. So there are those thresholds that have been set, which we have publicly consulted on them, and we continue to want to improve them to ensure that we don't provide perverse incentives for Eskom. But I think the answer to where those thresholds should be is also not a question of science, but probably an art that we have to go through as we regulate and learn to regulate this. Even those that have regulated for 100 years have changed it 100 times. The question around whether we are containing the building costs is also a matter of this RCA. I said when we started that Eskom started by saying they will spend 100 billion rand per annum, and they haven't spent that. And yes, we do get reports. Yes, we do look at that. And in that part of deciding what goes into the regulated clearing account, it is a session that we would have where Eskom has to prove to us that they have been efficient in the way that they have procured that. And these costs have not escalated because they have been inefficient. And if we go back to that part of the Act, which I think even my colleague from DOE has mentioned, that was where an efficient licensee is only allowed to. So if they have not been efficient, and I think that's the part where sometimes the view of those who have not looked at the books and the view of those who have looked at the books who have a difference in what is considered efficient. So if they have not been efficient, the law says that we must take that money away. Yes, the costs have gone in a direction that is not the one that was anticipated. But I think that there have been challenges. So to try and answer it in a short question may not be fair, but I think what I want to stress is that where they have been inefficient, then that is not going to be paid for by the consumer. But where they've done things efficiently, and yes, we want the cost to be controlled, it can't go on forever. There can be penalties that some of the penalties where they have not been efficient or careful in the way they did things are not going to be paid for by the consumers. But in some of the things that they have been efficient and they had no other way out, I think it is also fair to allow the consumers to pay that. So, but the pressure is there. It's not a six-monthly report. We've got a quarterly report, and I think we've been to the DUPI as well, although you don't see much when you're there in as far as this, but we are keeping a tab and an eye on the cost, and we are also saying that we must get the reports, and we are getting explanations. We are giving that the reason why the RCA has got that number, 3 billion rand, part of it is because those are also the costs that we have seen that they are not necessarily efficiently or prudently incurred, so they cannot be given to the consumer, but like I said, it can shift the other year. So if I were to give a short answer, I'd say yes, but we still can improve, and we will improve, because building two power stations is something that has not been done in a long time, so we are learning also in the process. But if you're saying let's learn faster and ensure that the cost, I think that we endeavor to do and continue to try to do that. I think Honorable Mbato is probably answers your questions as well. The last one that Mr. the department has asked me to address is the part about the reduction of work and whether, I mean, we don't know if the shareholder is going to want to reduce their returns, but I think the reduction of the work can come from the fact that you would have spread your re-evaluation of the assets over a longer period, and just that action will then reduce your returns that go to the shareholder, even though the WACC stays the same. But because your regulated asset base, which is what you multiply the WACC with, is reduced, it will then reduce that. So it is from that perspective that the talk about WACC is that if it's reduced, it can have a lower price part. That if you increase the time, it doesn't matter what method you use for replacement of your assets, but if you say that my assets, then as I have reevaluated them, they become a billion rand. But I'm going to phase in that billion rand over 5 years, as opposed to 10 years. Then you do affect your weighted average cost of capital. The department is directing me to answer on something I don't know. Alternative funding models on the new generation model.
Alternative funding model was a question that I was posed to ask.
Okay,
from Honorable Ross. Oh. Okay. Yeah. Compliment. Are there any follow-up questions that members would still want to? Do you propose that we take a tea break and come for follow-up questions, or we still have a lot of follow-up questions? Okay, let's break for tea.
To cover the two plants and deal with
Sorry.
Thank you.
should be an exceptional situation where you take somebody who has, let's say, 13 years work experience or 15 years.
And then maybe matric,
with brilliant performance, and you make him director. Not your minimum requirement. Oh, this is ridiculous. This is actually telling people, hey, don't go to school anymore. Come, get a job with your matric. This is where the country's problems.
I used to. I'm retired now, so I'm just a consultant.
I have a brother, my elder brother. He graduated from the University of Western Cape. Doing a master's in geology. He is very, very interested in working with fossil. He has been trying to continue to work with fossil.
I'm successful.
It's quite challenging.
Yeah. Well, geology is obviously in the mining. And I guess in the... you know, guys are looking for gas and oil and so on. I've been retired now for 12 years, so I hardly know the people there. I mean, they've changed so fast. actually very sad that such a lot of graduates in the country can't get jobs.
Yeah.
See, that's also happening in China. China is having the same thing.
I really don't know what could be causing it. Because you find huge number of graduates, huge number of graduates who are just not able to get themselves into the system. So they end up doing menial jobs which have little or nothing to do with what they study.
But okay, I don't know the statistics, but I would have thought that guys that in the technical field, like geology and science.
Okay. Honourable members, may we proceed with further questions? I saw the hand of Honourable Khayling. Oh, sorry. Honourable Rose, Honourable Ghalebe. Okay. Three. In that order.
Actually, let me pursue my line of questioning then on the cost as well, because I think it is something that we need to get complete clarity on. And you said that where there are not efficiencies or that there's inefficiencies on the part of Eskom, the customer or the consumer will not be forced to pay. But essentially somebody has to pay. I mean, if it has to come out of Eskom, then it's got to come from taxpayers or something. It's a state-owned enterprise. So, I mean, on that question though, I'd like to ask then, what is the situation with regards to penalties for Hitachi, for instance? Because clearly we know that one of the big delays in Medupi has been a problem with the boiler contract, and Hitachi has been the primary one there. So if you say that inefficiency the consumers will not have to pay for, who is going to pay for that inefficiency? Is there a penalty that will be imposed on Hitachi, or what is the situation in that regard? If there is a penalty, what would that be? And what's the regulator's role in enforcing such a penalty? Then you said that 20 to 30% of the coal contracts that Eskom has at the moment are short-term, which is a frightening figure, because I think the average long-term price for coal is around 135 rand per ton for coal. But for the short-term contracts, I think the average price generally goes up to about 350 rand per ton. So who is paying for these short-term contracts? Why do we have such a high number of short-term contracts? And what is being done in the long term to alleviate this? Are more collieries being opened up closer to some of these power stations? Or what is the plan from Eskom's side in order to reduce the number of short-term contracts? And what is the regulator's role in terms of ensuring that that, in fact, happens? And then lastly, the last cost is, and I can't get an exact figure on this because they tell me that it's confidential, but maybe Nursa can give us some insight into it, is how much is the buyback schemes that Eskom has implemented costing each month? Because we need to, because that obviously adds to the cost as well. And does that go into the kind of determination in terms of the multi-year price determination to fund such a scheme? How is that funded in terms of the price of electricity? Thank you.
Ross?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think what we're trying to find here is the balance between the affordable pricing to be affordable, and Eskom to be sustainable. And we have currently a pricing model as it stands that includes the full cost of new generation. Now, the full cost includes includes, and that would be my question, includes the generation costs, the new expansion costs, and also the interest costs. Now, Mr. Bakula's used the word ideally. From the consumer point of view, I would like to say, ideally, it would be for consumers to pay for consumption only. If you consume electricity, you pay for the price of the electricity. But how the cost is then calculated, that's where the problem comes in. Because consumers now pay upfront for capital expansion costs and for interest. And to pay upfront, and in the last 3 years, we had escalation in prices of 68% from Eskom. That's the information I have. That's without the municipal surcharges levy. 68% in 3 years. Now, in terms of the pricing model and the policy that we need to adopt, I think there's a huge challenge for us for the Department of Energy to say we have to look, and I think there's a lot of progress being made in alternative funding that we've discussed. That's true. But we have to look at the pricing policy as it stands that will not include the full cost of new generation plants. I'm talking about the cost of construction. Because ideally consumers pay for consumption. And they will pay for the user pay principle for the interest on the loans for the construction. But I don't think we can expect from consumers to pay upfront for future generation plants and future consumption. I think that would not be correct. And that's the principle we need to address. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Chair, I think my question was almost similar to the one of Honourable Khayleng, but my question sticks to the issue of the, you know, the coal trucks, because I'm just thinking, you know, the distance between the stations. I've been trying to look at the station of Gusile and the coal producers around there. It's a little bit of a distance. I'm just looking at what probably if Eskom can be able to assist us in what are the plans do they have in terms of transporting their coal to the station and ensuring that, you know, there's no damage to the roads, because it's very unpleasant in Mpumalanga. I ended up buying a bike because my low car is always damaged by these trucks when the roads get damaged. I just want to get a clarity in terms of that. And in terms of what how far is that process of the rail construction of, I think it was from the side of Andrena to Ermelo, if I'm not mistaken, to Camden, and the one of KZN, because I think the issue of rail becomes more effective, efficient for the supply of coal to the areas, because it's one of, because it will be able also to assist in terms of your stockpile. You don't find yourself, you know, getting low in terms of your stockpile, so that you can be able to meet your what they call it, the 40 days of operation without, you know, going down. The other aspect, Che, you know, this really, I was not satisfied with the answer of the issue of the free basic electricity. That, you know, some of the other municipalities, they offer the 50 kilowatts. Some of the other municipalities, they offer 100 kilowatts. I want to ensure that at least you've got a standard here, so that you don't find other people benefit more, other people benefit less. Because those are the issues that also cause political turmoil. Because we can't instigate people, find people marching for electricity because of the inconsistency that we cause ourselves. That's why I must be able also, NERSA, when you engage with SALGA, must be able also to find consistency in terms of the supply of the free basic electricity, so that we will find ourselves not having that challenge. But the other issue, the issue of the rates, see, I'm coming from Malwa to the municipality, where the other part of the municipality, the electricity distribution is provided by the municipality itself. But the other part, because of the ruralness, is provided by Eskom. But you find that the rates there, they are different. That's why I want us to be able to ensure that there's that consistency and balance between the two, because producing less. It's a problem. I think it's one of the other things that must be able to find synergy within. So I have to find consistency in all the things that we deal with. Thank you.
Okay. In the absence of any further questions, let me just add my two. To Mr. Bugula, just to because I want to add it to what Honorable Ross has just said. You know, we tend to focus more on the generation costs. But according to your methodology, you look at generation, transmission, and distribution. Can you be able to enlighten us on that? Secondly, for DPE and ESCOM to end their, and DOE to end their keep, so that they shouldn't just come here and not go without answering the question. On the issue of why do you want a coal policy? And then secondly, the Honorable Craylin talked about coal costs for short term or long term, but what's happening, I know it might not be within your remit as NASA, but what's happening to the coal cost on exports? Would anybody be able to tell us about those different costs? Because I know the export coal costs are much, possibly even double that day for those which are for short term. I don't know, but I might be wrong with my assumptions. Yeah, those two. And I mean, just for the sake of, for the purpose of the general public and members of parliament, Mr. Bugula, how do you ensure that ESCOM operates its OCGTs prudently?
Well, I guess Nelson has got the auspices that government always stuck to. Sorry, because the legislative people. DP will add on the issue of coal. Let me start with the issue of free basic electricity. You see, in terms of the department, what has done is that when the president announced the free basic electricity in 2000, it was President Becky by then, all the sector departments were supposed to come up with a policy. And the department has done a policy by then, 2002, which was published. And the policy is very, very clear. It says 50 kilowatts hour per customer or per customer. But when we're developing a policy, there was a challenge to say that if you look at the free basic electricity per se, it has a social implication. And to a certain extent, it's a municipal prerogative in line with the municipality to a certain extent. So in that regard, we have a harmonized policy which dictates or guides the municipality in terms of free basic electricity. But to a certain extent, some municipalities, because of affordability, because of the issue of the number of or the demand of free basic electricity, they either manage to go up of 50 kilowatts or some are lower than that. The few years ago, even now, the department was still looking at when should they ultimately review that. But as you know, that there's a thorough study was done to come up with 50 kilowatt per hour for poor person. To a certain extent, it was an average. But then the need of harmonization goes to an extent of municipality itself also aligning to that figure. But unfortunately, it's more of the prerogative from the constitutional and the responsibility of municipalities whereby they tend to deviate, and then which then it becomes a bit difficult. But we can just, we usually in our meetings with municipalities give them those highs and lows around either going up and the implications thereof. But the fact of the matter is that we need to harmonize, not just free basic electricity. There are other issues around services that are also differing on that regard. And it's a very serious concern to the government as a whole. How do you harmonize that and make sure that you give the service to all? I'm just going to do a bit of a brief, a background brief, but the DPU go to a bit of a detail in terms of the coal roadmap. The policy and the issue around coal. Well, in terms of the coal to mainly to the supply to the power station. As you know, that Eskom generators buy coal and they use coal on them. But the issue of a pricing has been an issue, it will always be an issue around the coal. And that's why in a few years we have been developing a so-called a roadmap to the coal, which then a critical issue whether around to ultimately have a proper forum and a proper plan for the coal that will ultimately also have a proper pricing on in terms of it, and also proper harmonization of all the issues around coal map, so that all the mines and all the pricing around and all the usage of coal become consistent. But I will let my colleague to go deeper into other issues. They are mainly the NERSA issues they will answer. Before NERSA start, I'll request my colleagues not just to come here, but to answer some questions.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Honorable Chair and the honorable members. From the DP point of view, I think what we have been concerned about has been the fact that the primary energy constitutes the bulk of what our price outlook is going to be. And we have asked ourselves deep questions and said, what needs to be done differently to ensure that we contain the cost of coal in particular as the major component in that aspect. Now, in trying to do so, we have asked ourselves and the Ministry or the Department of Mineral Resource to look into how best can we be able to secure enough quantum of coal for primary, for internal use, or for domestic use in that context, while also allowing a space for private sector to still play their role in the export market and all those stuff. And this has been mostly mitigated or prompted by the fact that we have observed recently that even the less quality coal, which is supposed to be targeted for our own market, has been leaving our shores, particularly due to the demand in India of the same quality coal which we are using for our own generation. And so then we need to do something different to secure that. We then engage Eskom and ask the same question which the Honorable Freeling raised around the fact that what is your long-term coal strategy? Where do you secure and how much have you secured thus far? So that we're able to sequence our planning going forward in terms of how we secure that coal. And that study was done by Eskom, submitted to ourselves, we evaluated it, and we're looking at the geographical state of where our different fleet of generations are seated. This is the study which has became the critical input towards the development of the SIP 1, SIP 2 roadmap. It's SIP 1, SIP 2, which link Lephalale as the new hub for coal to our law field, which is in Mpumalanga, which is most of our plants are located, and therefore talk to what needs to be done from a logistical point of view for Transnet to invest in terms of rail networks that are able to secure and provide that required primary energy for that area. That work, colleagues, will have been, will elevate us or will make us realize objectives which Honorable Hadev has raised relating to impact of transport or road to rail, we could call it road to rail migration, as part of the delivery agreement of my minister and the Minister of Transport as to how much must move out of the road towards the rail, but also we must provide mechanisms to protect those who have invested in their tracking to also have a stake in that process of moving towards the rail process, which is a delicate process. We need to engage with the DTI to look into mechanisms to support those road coal transporters by roads. What mechanism must we put for them to be able to part and parcel of the vehicles which will be used for our traction business going forward?
alive to the reality that if all of us were sitting here concerned about the continuing escalation in primary energy cost, we can't sit and fold our arms. We must then be able to say there has to be intervention. And that's what we have said to the relevant department responsible for that aspect. But what we have done with ESCOM has been to say that ESCOM must then be able to secure enough long-term contract supply contracts, which will then be able to look into different models. One is cost plus, the other one is fixed contracting. But also migrating towards a process wherein the regulator is able to see the efficiency of how we've contracted as part of a contracting strategy to manage that efficiency and ensure that there's clear path in terms of ensuring that security of supply is dealt with. And that's what we think that we will be able to assist us going forward. Lastly, probably from where I'm seated, which we'll need to talk to, there's a question which says what is the role of the regulator in ensuring that where there's inefficiency in our contractors' performances, how do the regulator intervene? I think that the regulator has said that on a quarterly basis, we, as government and regulator, we look into the books of ESCOM and how it's performing. But also on the monthly basis, as the department, we've set a steering committee with ESCOM, which looks particularly on the new build program currently. It looks under the performance of the different contractors. We look into when do we activate penalties, because in the contracting strategy, there are penalty regimes. If you underperformed, we penalize you. That's part and parcel of a contracting strategy. It's been there built in. And in a situation wherein, I want to be just alive that if, for example, as an example, put that Hitachi is not performing, what is that we're doing? We'll talk to Hitachi locally. We'll talk to Hitachi Europe. We'll talk to Hitachi headquarters in Japan. And said, this has come to this point, therefore we think that we must be able to activate our sovereign powers around this aspect, because your contractor possibly or your subsidiary is not performing in our country, it's threatening our security of supply, and therefore we need to act. Therefore, we have not become a laissez-faire kind of a shareholder. We have become so involved in the operations and to extend our own ESCOM complaint that we are over-managing them. Because we say that there is a value for us to ensure that we deliver on time, because the regulator will then be able have an issue with us not able to spend the money we said we want to spend, and therefore we need to deal with this. let me end, Chair, with I think that ESCOM might add on these aspects relating to the buyback contract. Part of our levers, which when we give ESCOM a PFMA approval to go secure short-term measures, and underline it, it's short-term measures. We said clearly that we want to ensure that you have indicated to us that there's a gap between the supply and the demand in the next year and a half leading to end of 2018. We want to know where we're going to get that additional capacity, and the strategy we evaluated was that, no, we'll go and look into cross-border. We'll look into, that's one of them, we'll look into the usage of OCGT. We'll look at energy efficiency and demand side management program. We'll look into your interruptible loads strategy and how we deal with those customers who have in their contracts have got that provision. But we will also go to those which we are supplying them, who due to unforeseen or global economic conditions might not be able to function at a full load. We know that the customers of ESCOM will not, because of electricity constraint, because their parent company, wherever they're feeling the pinch in Europe, when Europe is bleeding, chose to say, no, we need to not to be able to do it full load because of this impact. Then we went to them and said, if we were to come back to you and said, can you sell back power different variables around that. But what we've done, because we've put a weekly task team on our group members, which look into the performance of those short-term measures. That weekly task team main focus is on weekly basis we evaluate the performance of each and every initiative. When we decided that by the end of May, that ESCOM you must not continue with buyback. We said we are concerned that if we continue with buyback, it might become too costly. There's no guarantee that the regulator will allow you to that cost to pass through to the consumers. Therefore, you have to be prudent. Therefore, within that prudence, we have to look into that. The same with the open cycle gas turbine. We said we are not agreeing that you must use it beyond what the regulator has allowed you to use, unless you go to the regulator and said, can I be given permission to use it a little bit higher? And then if they give that in writing, then we can then be able to activate it. If not given that, we can't. The last part around this matter is around the energy conservation scheme, which will be part and parcel of what we wanted to conclude all the time. That we'll then be able to target the big consumers who are driving our demand high, which then become an impact to everyone, even our own residential customers, end up feeling the pinch while they're not the major drivers of that demand, except during the peak period. And with that, we need to find a way that we must conclude the energy conservation scheme. We are sitting at NEDREC. That matter has been taking. We hope we will find a resolution with business in particular around how to put it to rest for once and then be able to go out and say these are the rules. The regulator will then develop the rules in terms of how we're going to be able to trade within that, using that energy conservation scheme as a mechanism to drive our demand down going forward, become part and parcel of our life to the future so that we know that we have embedded a culture of energy savings within ourselves, those who do business in our country, ourselves as customers, how to do it broadly. And we think that will provide the necessary cushion as we move forward in that aspect. As regards to the call for, I think I've talked around the broader call, but for Kusile in particular, part of our strategy, what we said to ESCOM, we said that your primary focus must to look within the vicinity if you can get enough quanta. Because we didn't want to put externalities, transport costs, whatever, all of that. So look within the vicinity, but also provide a mechanism how we want to transit towards the linkage with the different investment we're making on the rail aspects. But in the case wherein there's a depletion of resources in Mpumalanga, you must not cry that you can't get the coal from the palace. You know, therefore, the development of Kusile must unlock a local economic development of the other town which has got enough resources. And that's the part of the broader strategy, which is housed within the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, which look into how best can we be able to leverage our investment which have made thus far. And I think that's how we have dealt with this matter in this aspect. But there was a question, Chair, earlier, which was asked. And we didn't want to talk to you. We have, as we speak, the funding for the current bill, the funding model and the funding strategy for the current bill program is concluded. But however, the percentage of how much using the different instruments going to offshore, local, and all these other strategies were considered. We've secured over 77% of that. But the future, we don't know, because the future is dependent on the determination. The sooner the determination is done, the sooner we know who's going to play in which space. In that, I think it was asked there that there's a call which was committed in 2018-14, 14-15, what is that call? We don't know who's playing there. Therefore, it must be in the plan there, but they need to be clear determination of say, oh, fine, that code, we see it. Can we understand who's the player? So that we know what kind of instrument you must use to go and raise whatever money you want without burdening users, probably by our inefficient decision we might have made. We're trying to avoid the same way of what we've done with Midupikusile. Remember, we did Midupikusile without a funding strategy. Now, we can't go to the future of implementing the IRP in the same way. We must clear, upfront agree, how we're going to fund the IRP. What is the role of ESCOM? Is ESCOM going to play a role in nuclear, in open cycle gas turbine, or combined cycle gas turbine? And what does that talk to? And that's how we've come to it. Thanks.
ESCOM? Do you want to say anything on the buyback?
Chair, there's not much I can add except to say that given the situation with the system that we've been experiencing, what we looked at is all options to try and get as much power onto the grid as possible. The buybacks was a mechanism that we found more efficient from a cost perspective because it was always cheaper than your next generation option you would have used. And that's the criteria we used for the buybacks. And, yeah.
The question that Honorable Failing asked really was around how much the buybacks are. I don't have the number now. I'm not sure about any confidentiality around that, but I can only commit that we'll provide you with the number and deal with the confidential matters. I don't think it's confidential, but it has been applied for, and there was a PFM approval from ESCOM's side. From our side, we'll treat it in the way that we'll treat matters of the RCA because buyback was not part of the strategy that was put forward, so it will have to be justified and all of the other things that go with the other operations or undertakings that ESCOM has gone through. But the number will provide. The cost and the part where I said that consumers don't pay for it, yes it is true that it goes to ESCOM's bottom line, yes it is true that because it goes to their bottom line it will then reduce the dividends, but the question is what else then would we do? Because yes, reduction of the dividends would then make the shareholder understand that if they have an entity or a company that doesn't do what it's supposed to do in the way that it's supposed to do, then they will get less. The fact that it would mean that taxes would increase if government was banking on those dividends really is a matter that needs to be considered elsewhere. But we do our part in the control that we've been given. Penalties to Hitachi, that the jury is still out, and I think as part of the MYPD3 and the regulated clearing account, all of these things are going to be out in the open. In the three or six determinations that we have done, I still have not seen something that has never been put on the table in as far as what is it that we determine and what is it that we allow in those different line items. So when this matter is concluded and when there are penalties that are due both by ESCOM or Hitachi, we will apply the same principles that we apply to ensure that if we believe that this has not been efficient, then it is not going to be incurred or recovered as the cost of operating that business. And part of the consultation we are going to do for the MYPD3 is around really reducing our own power as a regulator because we've got this power of deciding what is efficient. So we are putting it out there to say that let's consult on what we are going to consider efficient so that those who are playing in this game know the rules. They don't come back and say we didn't know that if you do it like this it's not efficient. So part of this consultation with the MYPD3 will really come up with those things that say that for us we consider that it is efficient when it's done like this, and if you have a different view, please let us know. So we will have a pact and a compact as South Africans to say that when we're looking at efficiency, this is what we have agreed on. But we'll do that. Now, on the short term and the other contracts, sometimes I think we need to accept that there are some truths that have to coexist, and they may be looking that they are conflicting. The first truth is that we are now operating our power stations well beyond their design capabilities and load factors. That's a fact. Whether the other truth is that we should have built others, it's also another truth, but let's let's deal with this one. Because we're operating them beyond and above the 60% and 40% design factors that they were supposed to be operated at, the mines as well are also not producing. They knew what the design factors were. They were producing and mining and buying the equipment in a way that would meet the contractual obligations that Eskom had with them to produce the coal. So mines can only produce this much of coal at this quality and within whatever the contractual arrangements are. But when we operate them at 80%, the mines then may not, some of them are not able to produce that amount of coal because it's not within the contract. And if you want it to be within the contract, they would make it cost a little bit more. And some of them have used that. So the alternative then is to get coal from other sources, which is when we then go to the short-term contracts just to deal with this, because after we have built Kusile and the other stations, yes, we are going to derate these wells and we are going to then operate them at the level. I was hoping Eskom would explain this, but I'm explaining it from why we allow it as the regulator that they may have the short-term contract. So once we get to that point where they are operated at that, yes, and the short-term contracts will have that price, yes, from the figures that we have, it's around 260 rand per ton. But it's because of the transportation element of it. And to link it with what you had mentioned, yes, in the multi-year price determination, MYPD2, we approved funds to do the rail link between Tutuka, and it has been built, and there's a train that's running in between those two. So part of the big strategy of ensuring that we reduce this was implemented in MYPD2 as members and everyone else had suggested, and it is now working, and it is reducing those costs. Yes, it is still going to be a big network, but the Tutuka link, which was the one that was approved in the MYPD, has been implemented and it's working. So the regulator plays then that role in ensuring that the contract that they have, and I think in 2008, the view that the regulator took was that the mines that have attached to the power stations that have a 20-year life to supply the power station, rather than having the shortages that we had of not having coal, let them give you all the coal that they have. The problem that we would have of them not having coal to supply the station for the life of it, we'll deal it with when we get there. But we also have to retract and say that we can't deal with that problem when we get there, because it's not going to be easy. Let's deal with it now. Let's allow the short long-term contracts, because these short-term contracts, some of them are 3-4 years. But we know that we have a plan to deal with it going forward. So that's the role that we have played, and I think 2008 power shortages taught us those lessons. Honorable Ross, yes, it is true that customers should not pay for future, and I think that we'll strive to get to. But the point I would like to just raise and stress is that in South Africa, we have chosen the route of saying that we pay for energy only. The truth and the fact of the matter is we put the capacity part into that energy rate because, and here's how it is. For us, we are expecting to go home, and when we switch on the lights, they must be on. And Eskom, on the other hand, is supposed to just run those power stations hoping that I'm going to go home and switch on the lights. So I must pay for the fact that there's that capacity. But the way we package our prices in electricity in South Africa, we say it's an energy price. It's not an energy price only. There's a capacity factor already built into that. In other countries, they would say you pay a certain rate. In fact, some of the tariffs that we have what is called a demand charge. That's just to say that when you want that power, I will give it to you. The fact that you are going to consume 10 kilowatt hours or whatever is another story, but I'm charging you for the fact that I've got a line that goes to you and that has power in it for you to use it when you want to. But when you use it, I'm still going to charge you additionally. But your sentiments, I think the end game or the end in mind for everyone is that we should invest in a power system the way that you should invest, that you have retained earnings, you borrow money from those who have it, you build, and you only get customers to pay when you are putting that power into the system. And I think that's what we will get to. For me, I think we have gone over the hill now. We are going down. Eskom will supply at a rate that's lower than the municipalities, because Eskom only looks at their cost of electricity. Municipalities add many other things that Eskom does not necessarily add, and I think that's the problem that was tried to be solved by the RED and the other processes that we've had. But for as long as we have that differentiation between your local government and their powers, and that we are still going to have that. I don't think the regulator is in a position to solve that. It's a problem that sits high, way above the regulator. Then the one about OCGTs. OCGTs are designed to operate only for 30 days in a year. That's how they are designed. Now, when we allow ESCOM the money for their diesel and the other things, we only limit them to that. Hence, there's that other part around the regulated clearing account where they have to justify if they spend above that. Now it is not one of those things that they appreciate about having to try and justify to the regulator, because the most likely answer is no. So they find ways of really sticking towards that. And I think the other part where we talked about buyback is also another way of mitigating that. But so that's the one that we set for them, and they have to stick to that. If they spend more than that, it also goes to the bottom line. It does not get recovered directly from the customer, but it is something that they also really move away from using. They have to really prove that they've used every other option before they go and use that. And I think the limits for that are quite clear. And that report, we get it morning and afternoon. So if they ever go above that, they do know that they get a note to say that, why did you go to 97% for the past 2 days? Is there a problem? And then they autocorrect. But it's completely in there. And then the one about generation costs, and why we always talk about generation costs. In a power system, 60% of your costs, both of running it, building it, replacing, come from your generation part of the business. 10% come from your transmission. The other 30% come from your distribution. That's the minimum. In our case, our generation costs have gone to the 70% side of things. Transmission is sitting at 5%, and your distribution is sitting at 25%. That's why when we talk, it's those big generation numbers that are there. But when you look at the actual numbers, there's a lot of transmission strengthening, because once you've built the power station, you must evacuate that power. And once you've evacuated it, it must also get to the different consumers to be consumed. It's not supposed to sit and float. So, but it's because the generation numbers are the bigger ones, and that's why we tend to focus on it. And it's two power stations. With transmission, it's many different lines, and maybe we don't do justice to transmission and the distribution. But that's why the emphasis on the generation cost. I trust that I responded to the questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. I think that brings us to the end of our session. Thank you so much. We are looking forward to engaging with ESCO at the appropriate time after their submission of the application to NERSA. Thank you. Honourable members, next week, Tuesday, we'll be meeting again in room B227 on the report back from DOE on the scenario building exercise and further due diligence of the future of the transmission sector vis-a-vis ISMO bill. And Wednesday, 8 August, we have an invite from the Standing Committee on Appropriation to meet with DOE on their budget shortfall at the baseline. Thank you so much.